Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 94, where Tom, Pedro, and our special guest, Davide, are discussing the text, Situated Learning, Legitimate Peripheral Participation, by Jean Lave and Etienne Wenger, published in 1991 by Cambridge University Press. In part two, we will compare situated learning to other streams in the learning literature and examine what has happened since the book's publication. If you missed part one or to get the text, they are available on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. You know, my background is in human and organizational learning. And so when it came to things like pragmatism, now pragmatism was tied very closely with experiential learning. And you want to talk about a concept that's been reified and overused. Experiential learning is one of them. But Vygotsky is not the easiest to understand. And we sort of touch situated learning on the periphery as sort of like the third of the major literature streams. The division between experiential and situated learning was never really clear. That may be something to bring up since we mentioned the pragmatists, you know, we mentioned pragmatism. But we didn't do experiential learning.
We can tackle this heads on. So we can address these distinctions head on. And this is why at the beginning I remember sort of I mentioned that you have to always to say situated learning, legitimate peripheral participations in one breath, because the distinctions at the root of this is that for Lave and Wenger, you learn by getting legitimately involved in a practice, okay? So participating in the practice. How is this different from experiential learning? Well, experiential learning, especially in the way in which was sort of like retranslated or configured in the North American traditions, is actually a mental thing, okay? So it's the Kolb cycle in which you do something, you sit, you reflect on your experience, you elaborate your experience, and you come up with new ideas. So the learning is actually done off work, is done, you know, sort of away from the activity. It's something which happens in conversations or critical reflections. It's done with others, through others, but it's done always talking off work. So you do your things, then you take your experience, something you elaborate your experience, etc. So this is actually different from what Lave and Wenger said and different from what some of the pragmatists say, because when the Deweyan traditions of learning as an inquiry is that you go in the field and you say, you know, sort of like, so you want to learn about chemistry of the field, you go in the field, you take the kids in the field, you say, now plant this seed of corn and make it grow and go around and learn how much water it is. The learning in this sense is really learning by doing, so to speak, but by doing really. So that's the distinction. And that's why in the book, actually, Lave, I suppose, and Wenger insist that they have a view of learning and knowing as the capacity of doing a practice well. So for them, learning is not a mental capacity, it's just a capacity of acting competently in the world. And I think that it is somewhere this. In the book, they discuss actually this particular view of knowledge. So for them, knowing, learning, and practice are tied together. So the distinction is there that this is not doing something and then using this as an opportunity to reflect upon. It's really learning by becoming someone as you acquire the capacity to go on and do the things you're expecting you to do with all the risk involved. Tom, you were saying before, you know, there's an element of strong emotional elements, which I think in the books never mentioned. I don't think there's a word emotions never comes out or affect. Different times, different environment. We said this environment was mostly educationalists and technologists. But in the descriptions of the Via Angola, there is clearly the sense that if you are in a very poor neighborhood, extremely poor, and you are working on a piece of clothing and attaching the buttons on a jacket, that is one of the things that would generate a lot of income. if you don't want to make a mistake, not only because you don't want to disappoint your master, or because it can be a catastrophe, economical catastrophe for the whole shop and all things. In legitimate peripheral participations, you have a skin in the game. The skin is really your skin. It's not a skin, which is not the same thing as in experiential learning. Nobody ever is beaten up by having not learned from experience in a class or in a sort of reflecting exercise.
Well, it does raise the question, though, going back to the division example that you gave earlier, that, you know, when we're talking about the regular classroom setting, going back to what I said about, you know, there's a sort of the desire to do something practical. And I sort of got into this idea of comparing experiential from situated learning. You know, Lavenwanger and Dewey and a whole bunch of other people have all kind of used the same arguments against the traditional educational model and are proposing their models as being either an alternative or a much more accurate and useful representation of what happens in learning. The natural question that comes in is, all right, how do we transport the best parts or the desirable parts of this idea to what has been still is kind of the same old educational model that we've suffered through, despite the fact that we have all these learning theories that say that it doesn't work. Now, I'll offer one example, because with experiential learning, that's definitely one of those terms that gets thrown around quite a lot, that where anything that resembles learning by doing, even if it isn't actually learning by doing, winds up getting called experiential learning. You see where I'm going.
I mean, I have something about PhDs, right? So I don't know if it's relevant because it's a particular type of education. But I want to rewind just a quick thing before I say it. Because one of the things that I have read this book actually more than a decade ago, and it's one of the reasons why I decided to become a scholar, because I became very interested in these topics and how I ended up working with David and so on. It's the kind of thing that I read and forgot and read again. And one of the things that I assumed was missing and something that I work on is the role of structure, right? And org structure, so to speak, in these debates. But actually rereading, because they emphasize, they do not talk about structure in and of itself, but they emphasize the conditions by which someone can learn. Resources, technology, you know, roles and all of that, right? So it's basically talking about the physical, relational conditions. It's about talking about structure, so to speak. So, okay, so this long roundabout to arrive at my own experience in graduate school, so to speak. And rereading the book and thinking about that, it made me think that we have some assumptions about how what is important in such setting, right? Which comes from this general idea of education, so it's about classrooms and training and have a particular mentor and the mentor follows your work and so on. But, you know, reflecting on my own journey in light of all this perspective, clearly you see that a lot of other things matter that exist but are not put under the bucket of education. For example, the routines that exist and the extent in which you can see senior, you know, more expert people in the practice, like senior academics, talking about research, you know, talking about the practice, the extent in which you have resources to participate in moments and situations in which you can learn horizontally beyond your particular, you know, school. So whether you have funds to go to conferences and meet other people that are in the same journey as you, the procedures that exist. So the extent in which you can or not, and when do you select a supervisor, whether it's something from the get-go or after you have already had some relations with some people and then you select a person. So there are different models, different ways and different ways to arrange that, that different schools and different systems across the world use. And they produce different opportunities, which therefore produce different types of learning. Because I think that my takeaway of the book is how things are organized end up being what you learn, because it has an influence on how you learn. So I don't know, all this to say that we are still, so to speak, stuck with the model of education in the school and, you know, students sitting and someone talking and, you know, books and slides or whatever it is that is more or less still based on this idea that you're transferring. But there are a number of things happening that are always happening that we are more or less aware or more or less strategically in designing them to facilitate the learning, such as promoting the exchange of ideas between the students, for example, promoting the ability, you know, to have experience and try some of the concepts that we throw at them in trying to make sense maybe of their own experience and so on, right? You know, so again, it's not really about maybe changing the way things are set up in the education system, but being aware that a lot of other things have a role to play, and we maybe tend to see them as peripheral or tangential or just infrastructure, you know, or just somehow in the back, so to speak. But actually, they are important if we think this more enlarged way about learning.
So my view of the book and the concept, which is, I think, very much close to, I think, what Lave and Wenger had in mind, is that, so its value added is not so much normative as much as heuristic. Okay. So what I'm saying is that it's a tool, it's an analytical view, a tool that it's useful to analyze any kind of learning situations with us asking a number of questions, asking what is going on, what happens, asking if the way in which things are set up are aligned with what we want to achieve, rather than then giving suggestions on what we should do. So in that sense, apprenticeship is a normative, so like historically is a normative concept, right? So this is how you set up apprenticeship. Legitimate peripheral participations is the descriptions of a number of mechanisms that underpin learning, so that you can start seeing some misalignment. One logical, you know, sort of one typical misalignment is that of using tests in the trade school. I think his example was in the book a bit toward the end. Testing in sort of continuous educations, in adult educations, okay, so using testing rather than, you know, sort of as an endpoint, rather than the endpoint being the involvement in the community of practice and the community of practitioners. The thing is that from superficially, it makes a lot of sense. You finish a course and you do test, and there is evaluate the test against some criteria invented. You don't see the paradoxical situations until you use a concept like peripheral participations, which ask what type of practice does the testing participate? You know, so what is the social gathering or the social relationship, set of relationship to which it refers? And then you discover that testing is consistent with the fact that the community practice actually, so that you push students to become expert students, so to speak, rather than the extra practitioner, right? So you constitute a different community of practice, which is a typical stuff that happens. I think the PhD is a very good example. Okay, so if you do the wrong thing with PhD, you teach PhD how to be good PhD students rather than to become a good academics. Okay, so they become stellar students of a PhD program, especially in Europe, where the PhD program has been a lot of sort of turned into school program. So it's been structured rather than remaining much more aligned with the old apprenticeship model in other countries. For example, I think in the US is still like that. You can see the paradox. You can, so the tool doesn't tell you how to organize, how to design a PhD, but it allows you to see some of the incongruences by seeing through this. By the way, the PhD model is also a very good idea why, as I said with Tom Leven-Wenger, don't want to be, so their idea to be flattened against the apprenticeship, because any doctoral students know what are the dysfunctional aspects of the apprenticeship, or many, the less fortunate PhDs know the downside, you know, be used as poor labor, be treated like badly, be taken advantage, up to extremes of being sort of like, you know, assaulted, or which is part and parcel of this particular historical manifestations of this principle.
Yeah, thanks. And it spurs to mind, you know, the challenge that sometimes we do have as an educational institution, being able to demonstrate or measure progress or measure what it is that we accomplish. We say that we want to develop professionals, not just professional academics, but professionals of any kind, where there's a tremendous social aspect to it. I mean, when you become a doctor or you become a dentist, you're not just an individual practitioner. You're a leader in your office. You are a part of a community of dentists all trying to learn and maintain currency and the latest of everything. And the preparation is something that we would all agree and would certainly agree with Lev and Wenger, that those are the things that are the most important and also the things that are the most sticky over time. But how do you measure whether or not a institution charged with building that and sustaining that social fabric along with passing on teaching is doing a good job or not? Because it's really difficult to pinpoint what impact the institution is having on that social piece.
Yeah, but as I said, this is not something that you can find in this short book, not only because it's short, but as I said, because the authors are really adamant, okay, that they don't have the answer. They never tried, so the book never tries to either define the ideal legitimate peripheral participation process. So we have an example of how certainly doesn't work, but they don't say that the other cases, the other four cases are ideal types, so to speak. They are just types where you can recognize the mechanism at work, right? I think that especially Jean Lave, I think Etienne Wenger was very young at the point, but just finished his PhD, and his PhD was in computer science. So he was a very intellectually oriented and very knowledgeable Swiss person, was an European. So obviously he was taking a very broad view to this.
I have something I want to say, maybe as you were thinking. So Tom's point actually made me think that some of my notes actually for us that I thought we could discuss is, like you're hinting at, David, the sum of what is not on the book, right? And when we try to make sense of it through our eyes and our knowledge about how society, how schools, how learning, how communities of practice work in the wild, right? And one of the things that I feel that are missing is an acknowledgement that there is not just conflict with newcomers and masters or whatever, right? But there are multiple communities of practice, multiple practices and goals involved in each of them. So there's a lot of complexity in the social world, meaning that I think that some of the difficulties of connecting, thinking the possible relationship between such analytical perspective and the education system, well, we need to recognize that education system has multiple goals. That is not just learning, right? It's maybe ranking people and giving certificates for a number of reasons. That the complexity of the world is one in which we have separated in many occupations the doing of the occupation and where the learning or the certification necessary to then embark and be hired in some positions require, right? So I think that is, of course, as you just said, the book has a very clear agenda and it's very, you know, precise and concise. But I think that it would be a good conversation to try to think what happens when we take stock of the fact that the communities of practice, the learning is happening in this complex fabric of society where there are different competing ideas of what education should be, competing communities that, you know, may have a claim over a particular practice, right, on how education should be or not be, for example, and the conflicting goals that may exist related to an university or a high school, which is probably not just about learning of the students, but a bunch of other things related to it, right?
I'll give a good concrete example of that with one aspect where there's been concern that we're over-certifying. So we're creating degree programs, for example, at the undergraduate level, where the value of those degrees may not be necessary. I'm just offering this as an example. Hotel management. In past days, of course, we didn't require certification in something like that. A lot of it was on-the-job training, something that had a bit more of a situated flavor to it, okay? You would have the supervisor or you would have a high-level manager who would bring in smart people from high school who were not going to go to college and teach them the ropes in a simple sense. Now, we're seeing a lot more degree programs to produce people who effectively would perform the same role. And there's a question as to whether or not that is having the reverse effect of producing people who are better able to manage a facility rather than the old way, which was much more immersive, where you had a bit more of a social identity development component to it. That was kind of where I'm going with the question, what we think of that.
Let's try to respond with Lave and Wenger 1991 rather than, okay. So I think in the book, they make a big case that they don't want this book to be about schooling because they're interested in a generic and generalized. So basically, the book could have called Digital Peripheral Participations Everywhere. So that's the whole point of this, including schools. So their answer in 1991 would be, of course, the school is always straddling between two community practices, a bridge. There is a community practice of studentship. So, and in school, as we said before, you need, so the school is a machine for learning, for teaching students how to be good students. But there's also a bridging, so there's also, especially in the case of explicit professional schools, is also a ideal stepping stone toward entering the world of professions. So in 1901, Leven-Wenger would say, let's use legitimate participation to see, first of all, to what extent these two worlds are connected or completely separated. As we said, you can create a professional school that is modeled, in which the focus is just on creating the identity of good students, so to speak. And then when they go back in the field, they know nothing. Or you can use it also to see how much of connection is between these two worlds. I think later on, Leven-Wenger has explored the connections that people have between social worlds, between worlds. This is, so how people can go to one and another. So as a tool that would say, start to look into the good or the more thoughtful professional school, the one in which you have practitioner coming into the class, in which you have people going doing some placement of these things, but let's start to look at displacement and this visit through the lenses of peripheral participations, and let's see to what extent these things are effective or not. Okay, and so then you discover that sometimes the practitioner come to the classes, but they rather than acting like practitioner, they turn themselves into sort of like academics because they want to show off how good they are. And so you can also go in and examine how does this placement look like, what people do during this placement, whether they have access, when they have actually participations, whether they are legitimated by whom. So you can see how Leven-Wenger in 1991 would say rather than, the way in which we can do is just to examine, to question some of the practices that are used to see if they respond to some of the what we believe is the conditions for the mechanisms to work. And I will find some obvious stuff that, if you can send a person in a hotel, but if the person is put in the corner to do photocopies 8 hours a day, it ain't gonna work because legitimate participation needs that they've been involved in real practice where there is a skin of the game. They have to actually feel, contribute, etc. So you can see it helps a little bit.
Okay, so we stretched actually some of the ideas of the book towards the school system and so on. But another clear stretching, and we've referenced that already in part one, was the idea of communities of practice, and in specific, the type of idea of communities of practice that took over the world, right? It's very functional, managerial, you can design, how was later understood, and it's still understood today, right? So maybe we can think and reflect a little bit about the impact of the book, both in theory and practice, on how it has started a whole debate related to how learning and knowledge, knowledge sharing happens in organizations, right? And of course, some of the misuses and complications that happened in the process.
So having lived this story from within, so to speak, because this is, so I said, when I encountered these things, I started to study legitimate peripheral participations or situated learning at work for many years. I did several studies of this as a way to explain sort of like processes through which organizations acquire and retain expertise. And then I moved toward communities of practice. So participated, I was involved in some of the discussions. I would say that this is what happened, historically speaking. The book triggered initially great interest for organizational learning and learning in organization because it's a theory that applies to a lot of environment and not only school. It was considered as a godsend to people who are interested to understand how people learn in organization. And in the early 1990s, the response was through legitimate peripheral participations. That's it. Okay. However, two things happened. First of all, this, as I said, probably too many times already, it was always an analytical tool. So that, you know, so you analyze one case, analyze a case, you find the same thing. So it was a me too. The tools was enriched in the sense that you said, for example, you know, people start to ask, is it true that in school you don't learn anything? What happens to different, so what is the relation between institutions and legitimate for participations? You know, so all the five cases that you describe are small communities, quite traditionally structured. What happened if you go in the real world where, you know, these communities live within institutions and, or, you know, we call them occupational communities, and then a lot of things happen. There's a lot of tensions. But it's still an analytical tool. And so toward the mid-90s, there was this big split between those who are interested in understanding how organizations learn and those who wanted to have a more normative, wanted to tell managers, you know, how to create the learning organization. The argument was won, so to speak, by the normative people, okay, who went on to develop a number of models of the learning organizations and the condition for learning organizations, including Amy Edmondson, okay, which is... Amy Edmondson was dealing with these things and discovered that psychological safety was one of the conditions that allows legitimate peripheral participations to happen. Okay, so, okay, and the rest is history. Within management and business studies, the interest for legitimate participations dried up, literally. People just moved on and moved somewhere else. It basically went into two places. It went back to education. Okay, so it went back into classes in which people started to take on this idea that they said that this was a way of reading, learning, and active learning, and sort of like hands-on learning in different ways, which was richer and more social than the Vygotsky or the Dewan tradition. And so it started to be taught in school and be used to analyze class situations, etc. It went back to workplace learning, to vocational educations, where, as Tom was hinting, was used to start to analyze the effectiveness of some of the programs as are we doing the right thing. And then what happened is that in 1998, Wenger, who at the time, so, you know, sort of at the IRL, who published the books on community practice, and the debate stopped. So a lot of people stopped discussing about legitimate participations and jumped on the bandwagon on the community practice. So that is the story of what happened. So in many ways, very few people these days deal with these things in business and management. It's very much accepted. It's resurrected sometimes where people find, as I said, being study of shadow learning is a typical example in which people do again a study of professional learning and find something new due to the changes conditions. But in terms of consequences in the field, I think the long wave is more attached to the sort of illegitimate son or daughter, which is the community of practice, rather than actually this process.
Yeah, thanks. It does lead me to think about, while an analytical tool, it's very clear that there's a lot of utility in that tool, because we can look at how organizations, and I'm, like I said, I'm much more of a practitioner than a than an academic. When I look at you know, the coaching or the advising or whatever that I give, I can use their examination of the case studies and say that, well, you know what, there are things that can be done better in terms of how you leverage the relationships between the experienced and the newcomer, and to set the conditions by which you really do include them so that you don't repeat the lessons of the butcher case, or that you do better at, especially for organizations like mine, where turnover is really an issue. And so then there is a lot of difficulty in being able to, for anyone to build a lot of mastery. Like the difference, the delta between master and newcomer is probably less than in some of the cases that are given in the book. So how do you overcome that? How do you set conditions by which you can have fruitful relationships, not just up and down, of course, as we discussed, but also peer to peer? Because I think also one of the features of my organization is that it's very widely distributed. I mean, if we're talking about a community, this is a social community that's almost exclusively conducting remote operations on a fairly continuous basis. And so then it really becomes incumbent upon those who are members of the community to encourage the integration, the welcoming, onboarding, however you want to put it, of newcomers coming in to gain this sense of identity, even, and I'm not talking about a named community of practice. I know that that's what we're kind of trying to set aside. But the more, you know, informal, I don't want to say nameless, but there's a very informal identity associated with. We happen to be people working in a particular function among different divisions within this huge organization. So we sort of, maybe we label ourselves as the HR community or the whatever, but that's not really who we are because we have non-HR people in with us or what have you. And I think that that's sort of the thing that I look towards because I agree, you know, if you wrap around the formal, try to formalize the community of practice definition, we lose the sense of what situated learning and legitimate peripheral participation is about. There are ways that we can take this analytical tool and bring it into practical use. Is that fair?
It is fair. I think the one of the original justifications or hopes for the great success of community practice is that if you set up a community practice, legitimate peripheral participations will follow. So that was at least some of us academics were writing, you know, sort of that setting up community practice was a way to facilitate onboarding, to facilitate sort of the perpetuations of knowledge. The reality turned out to be quite different. But still, pragmatically speaking, even a, you know, sort of like even an informal community practice, okay, so can ask themselves using the concept, can ask themselves sort of like, are we ensuring that we are continue to become, to remain relevant? You know, who is going to be the next generations of us? You know, sort of should we take some people under our wings? You know, and in terms of using the analytical tool for doing something with it, okay, so recently I was trying to convince an organization to set up a system of onboarding base of some mentors and then the mentees meeting all together. So I didn't call it community practice. And, you know, so, and everybody had, so they will learn things by asking questions related to the practice. And I was told, no, this is too risky. So we'll do computer-based teaching instead. The model can still direct you toward certain things to do in the organization rather than others, which are fundamentally social and relational in nature rather than being based on you in front of the computer and absorbing things. So
this brings us to another topic I thought that we could spend some time on, which is technology and social change, right? We hinted at that in part one already, but I think that the challenge that we're experiencing, you know, looking back at the book, and what is the state of the world and work nowadays is that, of course, not only, as you said, Davide, before, the technology has become more black box, so less transparent. But as Tom was saying, you know, it's not just the case of the military, but many organizations after the pandemic, during the pandemic, in this uncertain future we have, the distribution of the workforce has escalated, right? And we are, you know, communicating through all sorts of tools. We are doing this podcast itself via Zoom, and we have been doing the podcast since the beginning remotely, right? So how these new mediums through which social relations happen, which we know is where is the locus of learning, bring new questions and new challenges for all of that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Pedro, and one that we continuously wrestle with because, like in professional education, there's such a difficulty, even though it's distance education, for example, is very, very efficient. It's efficient in certain ways, especially when it comes to budgeted and programmed resources. But the social aspect, and part of this challenge is what do we mean by the social aspect of building relationships? You know, that's one of those things that we tout as an important thing of this, of setting up an in-person environment where you have people, professionals getting together as they, on the one hand, learn about entering a new managerial level. They also get the chance to build a social network that is completely different from whence they came. Even as technology becomes more ubiquitous and as COVID showed, becomes a more integral part of how we do so much, I think what it did was it sort of reinforced the importance of the direct social contact, which we would associate with in person, but doesn't have to be in person. I mean, you cited the podcast. Most of us have not actually met each other in person. And yet we've built this rather, you know, robust social network that allows us to welcome new cast members and do all kinds of things and be able to keep the show running. You know, it isn't a matter of, I suppose, the technology. It's a matter of the quality of the social relationships that emerge from it because of how it's used is sort of like my reaction.
I totally agree. I'm waiting to see some proper research done on this. I haven't seen it yet. But there is plenty of early evidence or anecdotal evidence or that says that people who were onboarded during the pandemics are suffering. They suffered. They feel that their career progressed slower. They feel that they have learned less, that they have less extensive network, that they have less confidence than others. So we heard these stories over and over. As I said, we'll wait to see. But that will be consistent with the idea that they were lacking some aspect of a full participation, not only in the practice, but in the sociality that rotates around the practice. Okay. And so the question is, and you know, and all this debate around the hybrid work, et cetera, is rotating partly about this. Although this has to do with the learning aspect rather than the performance aspect.
It'd be interesting to see how the research actually does come out, because I do wonder, when I hear the conversations ongoing, how much of it is colored or biased by the fact that most of us have grown up in environments that favored a particular understanding of what learning is and what and the role of social networks, and that, you know, it may be that this new way is not as well understood because some of us see it as just naturally inferior or something.
Well, this is an interesting question. So actually, in the review article on the community of practice, one of the questions that we asked was that to be coherent and authentic to the message of Leven-Benger, one should ask whether actually legitimate peripheral participation itself is a universal mechanism or is itself a historical mode of learning, so to speak. We don't know. This is a bit of a paradox because, you know, they are both very historically oriented, but then they said that these things happen everywhere in all times. But, you know, so the question that you raise is absolutely true. If, you know, if in 100 years, community practice and apprenticeship will just have moved on and will have other modes of learning.
The other question I think that arises from listening to what you're saying is not just whether it's historically universal, but socially universal, right? And they talk about power, but there is some assumption that the people in these communities that are participating are a little bit homogeneous in a way. And I'm thinking just because of that, because again, there is no research yet. It's all, you know, stuff that I read in newspapers and it's all based on, you know, people's experiences, being interviewed by journalists. So it's just like, you know, it's very anecdotal. But minorities, for example, seem to say that their experience has actually improved in working from home, right? That they have been able to create other types of sociality of other people and engage in a different way in the practice, in a better way in which, you know, they didn't have to perform or do things or being mistreated the ways they would in the politics of offices and so on, right? Which, again, I think that is something that, in light of our current discussions about diversity and inclusion and all of that, it's a question to be asked that, you know, we need research. I have no idea what is the real answer. But I think that's another point in which we still have something to learn on that.
Absolutely. The book was criticized several times for inductively developing a general model from very specific and very, how do you say, so like unusual and extreme cases, so to speak. So they're all communities, they're all homogeneous occupational community, they're all small, they all have to do. So the book leaves some question open, for example, whether Jean Lave was a anthropologist who studied or went to university in the 50s and 60s. Okay, so some type of functionalism will have filtered, no matter how much she resisted, although she's strongly Marxist. So what I'm saying is that a little bit of a romantic idea that, you know, so that the Viangola or the Yucatan midwife were a happy bunch of people, really nice women, which I'm sure they were. Whether intentional or intentionally, if one wants to be a little bit critical, you can see that this is also a little bit celebratory book of a reality that is less and less common. So the questions of how much this processes work or can function, so how they interact with more institutional bureaucratical structures is open. I'm sure somebody is doing research about it. Actually, I know there is some. So this is again, this is our questions that have been asked several times about these things. So which comes to the limitations of, as I said, of a book, you know, which is 120 pages. But I said at the beginning that it didn't answer all the questions. I think this is the, it's a, Tom before asked, what is the legacy of a book like this? As I said, the legacy of a book have its trigger in a number of mountains of studies, but then a book that continues to produce questions rather than offer answers. And that's why we're discussing these things. And I strongly invite everybody to read it 30 years after we publish, once, you know, in an age where things that are 3 or 4, actually, according to Google, 5 years old is, you know, is too old, because age index only counts things in the last 5 years. So that means that things that have been written 6 years ago are just too old and should be read, and we need to rewrite the same things again. So
we thank Davide Nicolini for graciously joining us in this episode.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.
I would like to just one thing that the